Hello, defiers, mythbusters, and make-a-wrong writers. I am Brooke Warner, and I'm here with my right-minded sidekick and favorite co-host, Grant Faulkner. Hey, Grant.
Hello, Brooke.
So today's show is about challenging assumptions, which is kind of a thing that writers do. Many books' very premise is an effort to inform its readers that what we think we know is at least more nuanced than we originally assumed, if not flat out wrong. And right now we're in the midst of a major social and cultural upheaval in our country, and I'm discovering the great number of assumptions I've held about our history, for instance. Even knowing that the U.S. has a complicated history, I still held the assumption that we are a great nation, that we hold shared social values, and that we all want the same opportunities. And I held an assumption that we as a nation are fundamentally progressive. And well, it turns out that a lot of those assumptions are being upended lately. So an assumption is simply a thing that is an accepted truth. And boy, do human beings make a lot of assumptions. In fact, we all hold countless assumptions informed by our families, our personal experience, our education, where we grow up, and so much more. So Grant, I thought it would be a fun exercise to talk about some of the books we love that have upended our assumptions, just a couple. Is there anything that stands out to you as a book that just pulled the wool from your eyes and made you go, wow, I had that wrong?
Yeah, definitely several. In terms of books that really truly pulled the wool from my eyes and made me reinterpret my assumptions about the world, I think I have to lean into nonfiction books, though. I think of when I read The New Jim Crow a few years back, for example, it took my surface knowledge of how unfair our justice system was to African-Americans, or is to African-Americans, rather, and presented it in a much deeper and horrific light. We really have a caste-like system in the United States, and I say that because a majority of urban Black men are essentially warehoused in prisons. And then they're imprisoned outside of prison after they get out by being denied basic civil and human rights, such as the right to vote, the right to serve on juries, the right to be free of legal discrimination in employment and housing and access to education and public benefits and a whole bunch of stuff. And this has occurred in part because of the way police targeted Black men through the war on drugs, but it goes much deeper than that, of course. And, you know, just to complement that book with a work of fiction that really illuminates all this for me, it's the TV show The Wire. It's not a novel, but it has a very novelistic feel, and its creator, David Simon, is often referred to as our contemporary Shakespeare. And I just watched it with my kids. This was my second time watching it, and I really can't view the world through any other lens. Everything makes sense through the lens of The Wire. And The Wire, the reason that is The Wire shows the biases and the ineffective machinations of the system by telling the story of Baltimore, the city, through its police, its government, its unions, its schools, and its media. And what's amazing to me is the way it shows how, you know, individual people can have the best of intentions and be, you know, out there doing good, but the system is so much bigger and often so much stronger than they are. And I think that this is the value of fiction. It can make us feel a book like The New Jim Crow by dramatizing it. How about you, Brooke?
Yeah, actually, right in this moment, I'm reading and about halfway through Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee by the late Dee Brown. And this is a book I picked up specifically because of what we're going through in this moment. And it is challenging my assumptions in all kinds of ways. I was driving across the United States, as some of our listeners know, in June, and I knew I was going to be passing through a lot of Indian country. And so I wanted to know more about the history of the Native Americans. You know, I grew up like a lot of people, just believing, as I said, that our history was a noble one, even though I knew about slavery and what happened with the American Indians. And so people have been talking so much lately about slavery as America's original sin, but we really have two original sins, slavery and the genocide perpetrated against the American Indians. And it's a hard read, but it's also an important one. And probably the best way to bust our own assumptions is to read and be open to truth. And given how problematic our current media environment is, which really is biased on both sides, I think we do ourselves a giant favor to tune out the media and read more books. And I want to talk about today's guest, Mary Pfeiffer, and the book that made her famous, Reviving Ophelia. This book came out in 1994. I was 18 years old, and it's a book about adolescent girls. So I was the demographic that she was writing about at the time. But I didn't read it until I was 27. So that was a full decade later. But when I did read it, I saw my generation of girls so clearly in its pages. And the premise of this book was that despite the women's movement, teenage girls were struggling big time. And it still was a wool pulled from my eyes kind of experience because I had lived through this experience as a girl. But she identified this crisis of adolescence of things like suicide attempts and dropping out of school and running away from home and teen pregnancies and eating disorders. And I had seen a lot of those things up close firsthand with girls in my high school, so much so that it seemed normal. And her point was that parents weren't seeing how bad it was. And a lot of this was based on their own assumptions that the women's movement had paved a new era for girls, that these girls had grown up in the 1970s, free to be you and me, and that we were good, you know, and that just wasn't the case. So Mary is the reason that we're talking about challenging assumptions today, because it's a cornerstone of her work. And she's written 10 books about things like adolescent girls, eating disorders, climate change, and most recently about aging. And so she's drawn to these kinds of topics that urge readers to upend what they think they know. And I think this is generally a good place to mine for book topics. Don't you, Grant?
Yeah, definitely. And one thing, you know, that's so wonderful about this moment in history is how much of a role books are playing in it, in shaping it and defining it and creating the conversations we're having. I see so many anti-racist book lists shared online, whether they're lists for nonfiction books or sci-fi books or fantasy books. And so many of these books have been dominating the bestseller lists last month. So it's a consciousness-changing moment for the nation, and we're experiencing it together, and books are playing a huge role in building awareness, enlightenment, and connection, and by upending the things we think we know, as you mentioned. So this is all to say that we need stories to understand our world and overturn our assumptions, Brooke, and that's why we need diverse books.
I think that so much of literature is ultimately about challenging assumptions, and most of us understand that assumptions are dangerous, and particularly when they go unexamined or unchallenged. So this inherently makes for good book content. Consider that writers often spend a year, sometimes much more than that, with a book that they're just writing to make sense of what they know. And then the deeper you go, the more you uncover. And this is across the board. You know, we've done a show about research and its value in writing and, you know, expressing this idea of pulling the wool from our eyes. It's like, obviously, reading does that. And the deeper in you go, the more you're digging into your content, the more you're having your challenges upended, and then you're writing new stuff. This happens across all genres, nonfiction, memoir, fiction, and you start to see things differently. And, you know, it's honestly, I think, a blessing as a writer to be able to have that kind of opportunity to gain and add to your knowledge, and then even to discover new things that you didn't know. So I'm loving this topic for writers, but also as a reader.
Yeah, I love the prompt, Brooke, to take something you always thought to be true but isn't true. That's a wonderful place to start writing, because these are the moments of life that can be uncomfortable or liberating or both. So I just might give myself this prompt for my next writing session, because sometimes it takes writing to truly realize when we've even experienced such a moment. I read a quote from Mary about her new book, that it's not a how-to book, but a how-to-think book. And I really thought about those phrases. And a how-to-think book, these are really the best kinds of books, because we can inhabit another character or another perspective and literally feel our world changing. And her new book is on aging, which is fascinating to me the more I experience aging as I head to the higher digits. I once had to read a book on healthy aging for a psychology class on human development I took years ago, and I was struck by how older people tend to be happier than younger people, even though death is approaching and they experience more aches and pains. And this is in part because the people who are aging healthily tend to start living in service to something larger than themselves. The needs of the ego diminish, in other words. And that book definitely flipped my assumptions on aging. So it's wonderful to see Mary take that even further in her latest.
Yeah. And this latest book, Women Rowing North, you know, about aging women and challenging what we think we know about their experience. I read it and really saw my mom's generation, of course, because Mary is 72 and my mom is 75. And I work with a lot of authors who are in their 60s and 70s. And I thought it was pretty fascinating that Mary writes that women over 65 are, in fact, the happiest demographic. And there are a lot of reasons for that. She argues that they don't really care as much about what people think of them anymore, that there's a freedom that comes with aging, and that much of the angst that we carry with us when we're young evaporates. And so this is true of my experience in the friendships and relationships that I have with older women. And I also think for writers, it's an important thing, you know, to own this lifetime of experience that we've gained. You know, it's stunning to me that the industry is as ageist as it is, because the stories of the writers who I read who are in their 60s, 70s, and even 80s are so rich with depth of insight.
Ageism in publishing is a big concern of mine. I could go on a rant that would take up hours. you know, there are some cultures that revere older people for their wisdom, though, and I wish our culture leaned more in that direction, because I think we often discount what a person can contribute or what a person knows at a ridiculously young age. For example, I hear people being laid off in Silicon Valley because they're sometimes considered to be too old by even by their early 40s, which is very young in the scheme of things. And the same thing actually happens in the writing world to an extent, even though most of us are really just beginning to develop a richer, more nuanced understanding of ourselves and the world when we become older.
Yeah, it's so true. And so we got to be out there advocating for these experiences. And we'll start with Mary, who has plenty of hard-earned wisdom to share and who's still churning out New York Times bestsellers into her 70s. And so she's giving all of us who are concerned with ageism and publishing some hope. And she's an inspiration and an icon of this particular brand of how to think books. So we get to hear what she has to say after this short break. If you've been listening to our podcast for a while, you know that we have a partnership with Women Lit, which is part of the Bay Area Book Festival. The Bay Area Book Festival has done a phenomenal job of pivoting online this year through its Unbound series, and we want to give a shout out and encourage you to go online and take a look at the programming.
That's right, Brooke. And at the rate things are going with the pandemic, I think we're going to be restless for good online content this fall and winter. So I know I, for one, will be going back and combing through some of the programs I missed, shows like Unrigging the Rules for the Rising American Electorate with David Daly and Steve Phillips, and Shedding Light, Vanquishing Fear, End of Life Planning with the Experts with BJ Miller and Katie Butler.
Yeah, it's clear that it's going to be tough to keep it light right now.
True, but that's what Women Lit can maybe offer, Brooke.
Yeah, perhaps. And I will be continuing to host Women Lit interviews all year round. So if you want advance notice about those events and free tickets, please go to BayAreaBookFest.org and click on the Women Lit button at the top of the page. So far, the interviews I've done have been that have been collaborations with Women Lit include Eve Ensler, Layla Slimini, Emer McBride, Tyari Jones, and Chelsea Beaker.
All of those interviews have been incredible, and I want to remind listeners that you can go back and listen to those in our right-minded feed.
Thanks, Grant. And yes, everyone, keep this important resource in mind when you're looking for something literary to inspire you.
That and right-minded each week, of course.
Exactly. Welcome back, everybody. Today we have Mary Pfeiffer with us. And Mary graduated in cultural anthropology from the University of California at Berkeley in 1969 and received her PhD from the University of Nebraska in clinical psychology in 1977. She has worked for most of her life as a therapist and has taught at the University of Nebraska and Nebraska Wesleyan University. She was a Rockefeller Scholar in Residence and has received two American Psychological Association Presidential Citations. She's the author of 10 books, including Reviving Ophelia and her latest, Women Rowing North. Four of her books have been New York Times bestsellers, and she's also a contributing writer for the New York Times. Mary Pfeiffer, thank you so much for being with us today.
I'm honored to be on your show.
You wrote Reviving Ophelia during a time when you were raising an adolescent daughter And you later wrote about elders, then about climate change, and most recently about aging with women rowing north. So I'm wondering, do you tackle topics that are staring you down? And what happens when living your subject matter meets writing it?
Well, I always write what I feel like I need to most explore for my own benefit. So generally what piques my interest is a curiosity between the established ideas about a phenomena and my actual lived experience of that particular phenomena. So for reviving, for example, it was very clear to me as a therapist that what I was seeing in my office with teenage girls and their parents in no way matched the prevailing theories about adolescent pathology at the time. And so that really got me curious, as well as, of course, in that book, we had a teenage daughter. My husband's a therapist too. And we weren't by any means ideal parents, but nobody drank or beat the kids or had affairs, and we tried our best and were pretty open communicators and pretty gentle parents. And our daughter was like most teenage girls, angry and unhappy. So between my therapy clients and my own daughter, I really wanted to understand, well, what is happening in this culture that's not being articulated? Likewise, with my last book, Women Rowing North, I'm 72 now. Most of my friends are younger than me, but they're in their 60s. And I looked at the way the culture treated older women and the stereotypes about us, and I felt such a disconnect personally and also among my friends between those stereotypes and our lived experience. So I wanted to unpack that particular issue, but I also wanted to figure out for myself and other women, if I could, how is it we lead the richest, most meaningful, most joyous lives possible from now on? And that's a good, chewy question. So that'll be the kind of question that'll get me interested in writing a book.
You know, Mary, reviving Ophelia was such a success, one of those once-in-a-lifetime huge books that every writer dreams of. But for you, this led to a bit of a meltdown, or perhaps a big meltdown, which you later wrote about in your memoir. And I read one review that said, it will be difficult for many readers to identify with Pfeiffer's emotional and spiritual crisis that came with success. It is the dream of every writer to have a bestseller, to be on Oprah, and to be invited to speak around the world. And when I read this, I really disagreed with it, actually. I think it's quite easy to identify with the fallout of success, which has some qualities that are similar to the fallout of failure. Can you talk about this experience of success and how you understand it now, 25 plus years later?
Well, I think first of all, I think it's quite common for people who have some kind of very surprising public success in any area to struggle with that. It changes their lives. And there's a few people who are very narcissistic and want nothing but to be admired and feted and in the public eye. But especially writers tend to be quiet, introverted people who are not particularly comfortable being in the limelight. And in my case, I'm someone who stays very grounded by my friends and my family and my place. So the biggest issue for me was just traveling and working so hard and being in hotel rooms half of my life for about 5 years. And just the loss of spirit in me that came with that. You know, there's a saying that is, if all your dreams come true, keep it to yourself. And I think it is very hard for people who desperately want to be published to read an author that's a New York Times bestseller saying, boy, I really had trouble with that. And I empathize with that book. That book did not do very well. And it also came out just as we moved into a time of real financial catastrophe in this country around 2008. So the timing of it was very strange because most people weren't struggling with the problems of success at that moment in this culture. I liked that book at the time. I think it was a very honest book. Looking back on that time, I think the best thing about that book was for certain people who read it, it gave them permission to be totally honest about their own struggles with mental health. And most of the mail I got was seeking peace. Wasn't critical at all. And it wasn't about writing. It was about anxiety and depression and how helpful it was for readers to hear that other people had struggled with the same deep feelings of distress. The other thing that happened to me as a result of that book is I was catapulted into Buddhism. And the last, 15 years of my life, Buddhism's been a very big part of my life. So from my point of view, the book was a success in that it helped people, which is always my definition of success. And it was a success in that it led me to integrate those experiences in a way that allowed me to heal and move into something more beautiful than I could have imagined.
Hmm. Well, and you wrote an op-ed for the New York Times in 2019, leading up to the publication of Women Rowing North, where you wrote, "In America, ageism is a bigger problem for women than aging." And you also said, "Our country's ideas about old women are so toxic that almost no one, no matter her age, will admit she is old." And I certainly see this ageism because I work in publishing, which is a very ageist industry, a lot like Hollywood. And on the same note, we're seeing so many women defying ageism in Hollywood, in publishing, in politics. So do you think women who are defying, who are defiant, women like Nancy Pelosi, Meryl Streep, or Gloria Steinem come to mind, are they falling into that trap of not wanting to admit they're old? And if they are, is that such a bad thing?
Well, first of all, the specific women you've mentioned, I have no opinions on, and I generally don't opine about anyone. But I will say that women are in a very difficult bind, in that if they choose to avoid entirely the need to look youthful or beautiful in certain industries, they're devalued. On the other hand, if they want power, they need to be in those industries. So they are in a very difficult spot. And I have a great deal of empathy, for example, for actors and women in publishing and in leadership who dress and appear very differently than I do, because I'm a writer. I can have gray hair and wear sweatpants and make a living and feel very satisfied with my life. The thing I really tried to emphasize about this in the book is that when I was writing this book, women would say, "What are you writing about?" And I'd go, "I'm writing about older women." Invariably, women said, "I'm not old," because they could not bear to be categorized in the caricatures that we have of older women. And I think it's wonderful that there's a kind of a tokenism in a way of women who are older in the public eye. However, almost every day I hear a remark or see something in print that shows me how really ugly and toxic these images of older women remain.
Well, Mary, I'd like to ask you about your book about writing to change the world, which you're doing with your books. And it was published in 2007. And some of the questions you posed with that book were, don't we all want to be heard? Who doesn't want to transform the world? And who doesn't harbor a secret ambition to write? And these are all questions we pose people in my organization, NaNoWriMo, and likewise, one of your through threads with your writing and across all of your books is this deep commitment to encouraging others. So I'm wondering if you can talk about that commitment generally, and then also for writers specifically, what makes you want to be an advocate for others to use their voices and speak their truths?
Well, you know, it's funny. It goes back to when I was very young. I got a lot of credit. I was the oldest of six kids. And my mother was a doctor and gone a lot. My dad was in and out of the household as I was growing up. And I got a lot of credit for being a helper. and a good big sister. And I really enjoyed that. I liked helping people. And when I was in high school, I was the girl that everyone came to and told their secrets and their problems. And I was a good listener in high school, and I had a lot of people who liked to talk to me. And then, of course, therapy is a continuation of that. Being a therapist is wonderful work. Everybody that comes in taught me lessons, teaches me lessons in empathy and moral imagination and point of view. What I really wanted to do with writing was take what I knew and was learning from being alive and being a therapist and make that more accessible to a broader group of people. So, for example, the first book I wrote, Hunger Pains, was written at a time there was absolutely no popular literature out on eating disorders. And when women first started coming to me with eating disorders in the late 80s in Nebraska, where I live, I didn't even know what they were. I mean, I'd never heard the word bulimia. I'd heard of anorexia, but I'd heard it was a very rare condition that had something to do with Freudianism. And so when I started seeing all these young girls and women coming in with really distorted body images and relationships to food and eating, I really had to figure out for myself, well, what do I do to help? And then once I figured it out, I started giving a few workshops to nurses and other professionals in the state. And then I thought, well, why don't I just write this down so anybody in the country who doesn't know what I know can know it. So it was a very simple way to start of just, I have some information other people have, I don't share. Now, over time, my sense of that commitment to what it means for me to be a writer. There's all kinds of writers, and not every writer has to be like me in any way. In fact, it's great they aren't. But for me, I'm always writing for the reader, for the world. I have a certain set of ideas that I think are useful for living a happy life, living an ethical life. And I have a sense for what's useful in the culture. It's my sense, it's subjective, but it's also my value system. And so when I write, I try to approach a problem in the culture, an idea in the culture, in a way that's therapeutic for anyone who reads the book.
Well, Mary, I'm glad you mentioned moral imagination, because I picked up that term in your TEDx talk, which you gave a few years back, and it was connected to your book about climate change, The Green Boat. And it's this idea, I mean, it's prescient, maybe it's been forever, but it seems particularly the case now, this idea that we need moral imagination. And you said, good is what enhances the moral imagination. Evil is what decreases the collective moral imagination. Can you talk about your feelings about moral imagination today in this moment, given the multiple crises our nation is confronting?
Absolutely. I'd love to. Well, first of all, I think our leadership right now, and I'm speaking mainly of the president, are shrinking the collective moral imagination of people who follow him. And by that, I mean they're reducing other human beings in all their vibrancy and complexity to stereotypes, and furthermore to stereotypes that are hated and vilified. And from my point of view, with my value system, that's evil. There's no other way to say it. I think at this moment in our culture, first of all, nobody knows what will happen. I think we're at a moment of, we're at a threshold. We're at a threshold that if we don't let fear hold us back, could allow us to make decisions that greatly improve our culture in the world around climate change, racism, savage capitalism, and so on. And I think best case scenario for the world, and this may happen, we just don't know what will happen. What the moment calls for is a collective growth spurt in the moral imagination of all of us on Earth. And only if we have that collective growth spurt will we be able to survive as a species. When you think about the fact that a bat can bite a pangolin and take down the world economy and kill hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people, there's no way to escape the idea that we're interconnected, and that only by deeply appreciating our interconnection and sensing in the deepest parts of our heart that only when we work together to help each other will we survive, can we survive. So I think it's an extremely interesting moment in time. And it's a time when I'm doing everything I can, and I think almost everyone is doing everything they can to learn more, to talk more. You know, the Guntu Gras line of, it's the job of every citizen to keep your mouth open. And I think that's true right now. It's very important for us to be talking, to be listening, to be writing. Writers have a great privilege in that they're read, they're heard, and be doing everything we can to facilitate this growth spurt we also desperately want to need.
Mary, thank you so much for being on the show with us.
Well, thank you. It was a lovely interview, and I enjoyed meeting both of you.
Everyone, will be right back with Brooke's Takeaway.
Well, today's takeaway is an exercise from Mary's book, Writing to Change the World. She suggests that a writer try crafting a story from the point of view of someone you don't respect or like, or to get into the head of your opposition. She believes in starting your writing with where your readers are and not expecting that you will change ardent opponents. The truth is, she writes, most preaching is to the choir. Choirs produce almost all the important social action in our world. The people most likely to read us are people who think as we do, and readers generally seek reinforcement of their beliefs, not arguments or challenges. So give this a try. Fully step into the point of view of your opposition. See what happens and what it feels like to live there. Allow this experience to challenge your assumptions in all of its uncomfortableness, and see what that might lead to.
Thanks for that, Brooke. And we are here weekly both to confirm and build on your assumptions and challenge them. So tune in to Right Minded every week, download it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. And Brooke reminded me that we set an earlier goal this year to reach 500 reviews on Apple Podcasts. So it would be great if you could give us a review there. And we will see you next week. Bye-bye.